Hello and welcome to the Weird Things podcast. I'm Andrew Main, joined by Brian Brushwood.
Hello, hello. And that's it.
Brian, that's it. It's two persons, a two-hander, as we like to say in
just
the
like it's ever always been.
Industry. Yeah. I mean, you know, no dead weight here. I watched a YouTube video about a ghost city in Malaysia.
Ooh.
And really big, and you think, cool, ghosts in a city, like a ghost town. Like, no, ghost towns and ghost cities are two different things. And people are probably familiar with, you know, the China situation where China invested very, very heavily in real estate to the point that everybody there is like deeply upside down in it. And this CCP is doing everything they can to sort of manage the economy and keep it from like falling apart, because they have parts of it that are doing great, but then all parts of it that are literally terrible. And it wasn't just in China they built. They built in Malaysia this called like Forest City. And the concept art looked really, really amazing, really beautiful. And they actually went and built it. But like the Chinese tourists and people to go move in never showed up. And so you can like rent like super, super, super cheap there. You know, so what I'm saying is you'll see these videos from like these shills going like, ah, rent's so cheap in China, it's so much cheaper in America. It's like, yeah, it's because like their housing market just literally fell apart. You know, like 2008, you know, in America, you could get some houses, really great deals. And it's not so much the sign of an efficient city, you know, efficient economy as much as this. So Forest City, it's a ghost town. I watched a pretty cool YouTube video about it. You can see some stuff there of like just like shopping malls. Beautiful. Like it looks like a thing out of the future. Like this is going to have some businesses, you know, movie set location, but that ain't going to cover the billion plus dollars a year they take to maintain it. So,
Brian? Is it a case where they're going to abandon it? Or I guess you watched the video. I assume that you got something for us here.
Yeah, there's just their occupancy is like at 1% or 2%, and slowly they're gonna, you know, can they get occupancy to maintain it before the company that owns it, which is a conglomerate in China that owns it, runs out of money to support it. You know, and sometimes what happens to those projects when they kind of don't, you have to maintain them. They're being maintained right now. People go like, yeah, you see guys and workers like keeping things clear, but there's nobody there. There's like one restaurant open. Somebody goes, I went in there. There's a bunch of people. It turned out they're all staff.
Hmm.
And they all swarmed around and tried to sell them a $200 bottle of vodka. So, Brian?
Yes?
I have made you mayor of Forest City.
Oh, okay. So what's funny is as you were describing this situation, I immediately thought of, oh, good, you can invent Twitter, you can create YouTube, you can basically do all of the Web 2.0 stuff, because for all you youngins, gather round as us crusty old Gen Xers bestow upon you ancient wisdom. That's exactly what happened in both the infrastructure run-up and the dot-com bubble of the late 90s, also the run-up to Y2K. The spend was enormous, ridiculous. And yes, the quote-unquote bubble popped and internet was quote-unquote over. But guess what? With that infrastructure, suddenly you could come in very cheaply and do some ridiculous stuff and nobody could tell you no. So in this case, the first thing I'm going to do, you know what, Mr. Investor, look, I'm a first time mayor here, but I know that the fastest way to get energy going is to get in front of a parade, and I wonder whether or not modeling on something kind of like Burning Man might be an interesting idea. Get big names, outrageous spectacle folks, and get it on the map as a artistic hub. Because for every creator, so let's say, for example, somebody wants to make a movie, get some famous independent creators, YouTubers, cinematographers, And say, what would you do? Okay, but here's the problem. Most of the stuff I'm pitching is less relevant once AI is here. But I don't have to worry about that. The artists will figure that out. That's my big thing, is get people who want to take wild swings. Figure out what can't be done anywhere else and make sure you have a bed. Either that or a social experiment, turn each high-rise into a nation state and let them have their own, make them sub-mayors of burbclaves.
Remember, you're mayor, though. You're not the ruler of Malaysia, so that's the problem.
Okay. You know. Well, within a, either that or charge a lot of money for people to play high-rise tycoon, although as it's also known, being an actual high-rise kid tycoon.
Yeah, it's a tricky situation. They thought that it would be this big vacation, you know, look at, you know, people from China would, you know, come to go vacate, you know.
What was it that caused it to flop? Just is it the inconvenient location or they just overestimated?
The Chinese economy is way worse than people realize, and the money they have for, like, the number of Chinese people that have disposable incomes to kind of go do vacations is not there. Like, they were pressured by the government to invest heavily in real estate, and a lot of people are just really, really upside down it and paying for real estate that they couldn't fulfill or make do on. Like, these were all, like, probably pre-sold. They tried to pre-sell these to Chinese citizens, and there was just no appetite for it, because that was one of the things is they were selling. The boom was based upon advanced selling all these properties. You see these ghost cities in China, what they were is it was like Florida would happen. You know, the 2008 housing crisis was, a lot of it was second homes, was speculation. We have our home here.
By the way, that was when we pretty much lived in the Orlando area. The 2 years, 2007, 2008, I headlined at Universal Halloween Horror Nights. We got an Airbnb and I believe we were the only occupied house in the development. It was unreal. An entire development of these fine, I don't know, $350,000 houses, all of them empty. It was unreal.
Yeah, that was the problem with a lot of, like, you know, vacation stuff, whatever. You know, I told somebody, like, yeah, you know, we have a timeshare in Florida, and they started hysterically giggling, like, ah, my parents have one and they're trying to unload. I'm like, no, ours is at Disney World. Ours is actually cool and in demand. None of this off property BS. Literally walk into the Magic Kingdom. But yeah, like, it is amazing, you know, living in the Bay Area and looking at housing prices in Florida, and it's like, oh.
They went crazy since then?
They're low. I mean, it's just like, I mean, LA, I mean, here in Bay Area, our housing prices are, like, insane.
Yeah.
You know, what you're compared to, like, you look at a $200,000, you know, a $300,000 house here and like looking in a place like in Florida would be like a $2 or $3 million. It's like just completely different.
Yeah.
You know, that's a big challenge, is you have these ghost cities and places this, you have declining populations. You have this, some people, like, I've heard some people like, oh, Japan's a great model. I'm like, Japan's a terrible model. Like, there's less and less people look after the elderly people every year. Like at what point do you want, you know, I'd say grandma, but grandma don't got no kids. You know, what do you want older people to, like, have nobody they can call? So it's a tricky situation. And
we don't see the developer pulling out, do we? I mean, surely they'll weather. Well,
there's laws about that. Like, literally, the developer, if you look at, like, the developer has properties around the world, so they have to keep subsidizing this. So if you look up, it's $100 billion project.
That's a lot. That's like you could build like 10 of the Sphere. we were talking about the Sphere project, which the numbers weren't as bad as we thought, but Justin and I were talking about it. It was originally proposed at $1.3 billion and then cost another $1 billion, so it was like $2 billion.
Yeah. And Malaysia's got some really screwed up rules. Like, they don't let, like, citizens of Israel go there and whatnot. Like, just
wow.
Terrible, yeah. Terrible situation.
Yeah. So that's interesting. The fact that Malaysia and China, so it was for the Chinese economy that they were building it out and they were hoping to.
Yeah, Chinese investors built it in Malaysia as a vacation place for Chinese.
Yeah, that's crazy.
Yeah. I mean, you got a country that's got a large Muslim population, so you're going to be curtailed on some of the fun stuff you can do there too. So, you know, you can continue, you know, one of the other, you know, major forms of economic value for Malaysia is these call centers and pig butchering schemes. When you get those calls from numbers telling you, you know, and it's like, so you just turn it into a massive fraud call center.
Yeah, but unfortunately / fortunately, the robots are taking that job.
Probably the first ones, but the you know, we'll see, because like, remember, their cost on that is pretty low.
Yeah,
because they basically kidnap people, English speakers from China and other places, and take them to Malaysia and put them in the rooms.
No, that's but that's the part that I'm so interested in, is right now we're catching up to the sheer volume of scam calls and what have you. But I'm already wearing my Weird Things futurist hat, wondering, like, what happens when they become better than humans at being patient and being interested and knowing the right time to nudge people. Like, that's one of my my scary scenarios is, quite literally, if I had a budget and I was a forward-thinking criminal, then I would be spending all the bootleg compute I could on just making friends with males age 60 to 65, so that 5 years from now, you know, as voices comes in, great, now you got a voice model talking to them. As video models come in, great, you have video chats all the time. And then years from now, so that it's blurry to remember where the friendship started, then, you know, you could introduce your, oh, my daughter's here. And then, yeah, you may, whatever, it goes into a romance scheme. But the important part is you introduce enough characters. And then when you feel like harvesting the money, you invent a tragedy and it's like, hey, man, I really need $40,000. Are you good for it? Yeah, of course. Like if you called asking for a crap ton of money, I don't know that I would bother to question whether or not you are a human being. but that is... that is going to be a weird step.
Yeah, I think, you know, the question is, if, you know, I think there's so much opportunity right now in the short term. Like, you can do that in a week, you know, like a day. And like, a lot of it too is just mining and telling people, you know, oh, yeah, it's Andrew on a new number, and things that we shouldn't think would work. And, you know, Ben's better than I do. Things we would think shouldn't work all the time.
Yeah.
And we had a neighbor who got that number, you know, got a call, you know, a friend of our neighbors. The guy got the call from the number, like, oh, so-and-so, wrong number. Oh, who are you? And then like, oh, yeah, I'm Tina. I live in Miami. I invest in South Beach. I'm a hot Asian lady, and sends him a photo. And he's like, oh, like, okay. And then starts carrying on the conversation with her. And like, well, I can get you in on the deal, but you can't tell. Oh, okay. Next thing you know, the guy spent like $30,000, tells his wife he's going to leave her and he's going to go move off to live with this woman. His friends were telling him all along, it's a scam.
Yeah.
It's a scam. Like, it was like from the get go, they're like, dude, you know, this is a scam. He's like, no. And then finally realizes, oh, it was a scam. And you're like,
yeah, that's so I did a talk at PDXYZ, an HR conference, and my talk was all about how we haven't yet made the pivot to think of HR as critical security. But the exercise that I had everyone do is write down, think about people you work with every day. And then figure out in weeks, months, years, when's the last time you saw them in person? And now that didn't matter during the pandemic and all of the before times, but it matters now because, for example, there's I got a follow-up message from somebody who I hadn't spoken to in a few years, a name I knew, around 4th of July. And it turns out it was just an old friend, you know, rekindling our relationship. But there was a weird moment when it had aged out a good 5-7 years. I saw that the last text exchange was from the before times. And I'm like, I don't know what happened to this individual's phone in the intervening years. I don't know what got compromised where. So I had to do a little bit of weird talking around things before it became clear, you know, he referenced enough early things that it was definitely him. But anyway, I told the HR people that they need to think of that in-person meeting that as that invisible password, that thing that both of you, that shared memory that is unambiguous, that nobody could know.
It's just hard, though, because I get it from your friend, and then I tell you, and I'm leaving, you're so vulnerable because they're sloppy, and they're sloppy, and all you need is one person to be sloppy in a chain of eight people.
That's the case if it's, you know, a password, and that's the reason that I tell people, don't do passwords. Instead, think of shared memories, because a shared memory, you can approach from many different directions.
What I'm saying is, if I've compromised Justin and he doesn't know, and I'm in a conversation like, yeah, Brian asked me to share my memory. It was this. What was the one you did with Brian? Like, oh, yeah, that's then. Oh, cool.
And that's just it. It wouldn't be a single memory. It would be a number of them. As a security expense, so we've been wondering, like, why are we spending money on all these, you know, events, these holiday parties or whatever. Like, during a holiday party, you make a whole bunch of memories. And in fact, that was the point I made on the HR thing, was I did an improv exercise where Tom Nash, the guy I was doing it with, I challenged him to play PowerPoint roulette. He didn't know what the slides were going to be. And we picked a topic from the audience. And then during it, he had to explain, I forget what the topic was. It was a serious topic, but then there, he has to work in the fact that a woman is feeding a cherry tomato to a bunch of celery. And it was a funny moment, but all of those vivid memories, there's a whole bunch of them, so that now when we hop on a Zoom call, it's a shortcut. We'll both be able to reference that. And of course, you're right. Once those get burned, then what? And the answer is you have another event so that you're able to skip to knowing it's really the person.
Yeah, I'll take the counter on this and just we'll figure it out. Okay, because like, I look at, like, I'm in a situation where I get in when I'm asking other people for their time. Like, I run a couple signal groups and I'm told, let this person in. Mm-hmm. And sometimes this person's high status. And if I do, I have to have the most minimal way I can sort of say, really all I can do is just sort of, I need to get you on the record saying that you're saying you're the person that's doing this.
Right.
Because otherwise, I create so much friction that people don't want to do it. And that's the hard part is you create this situation of like, we see this in security all the time because some people are super, super into it. But also, if we follow everything they do, we could never deploy or do anything. And then other situations where people
what you're describing, that is exactly the problem. What you're describing is 100% the problem, because when you start with virtual presences from both parties, it is extremely difficult to verify everything, and you have to go to weird third parties, and the friction does get too high. Whereas being at an in-person event, like at DEF CON, just as soon as somebody was interesting, right there with them, I would turn, and with the phone in view, I would say, what's your phone number? And I would type, and then I would take a selfie of us, and I was like, hey, it's great. Mm-hmm. Like, there's no doubt. And then later, when I text them, it'll be in that same thread with all blue text,
that's good,
starting with our shared memory. And it to your question, I don't know what the answer is without an in-person event. I know that in-person events smooth that all over.
Yeah, in my role, it's not realistic because so many people I'm doing business with or engaged with, we can't be in the same room. But it's a thing to think about. Like a lot of it, I have to go for, like, does this person vouch for this person, et cetera. It's why it's a growing area. It's going to be the new trillion-dollar economy. Is just literally, it's going to be a lot of different strategies to figure out how to do this.
Yeah.
So who knows? I saw something really cool. Invisible drones.
Invisible drones? Explain this one to me.
All right. So type in YouTube, go look for, like, invisible drone.
All right.
And you'll see invisible drone. Yep.
There we go. Okay. What's the invisible part to it?
Have you found it?
No, but that was me filling
just
like air.
An invisible drone. Yeah, that one.
Oh, whoa.
So what it does is it spins so fast. It's got these rotors on the other sides. It spins so fast, it basically blurs itself.
That's clever.
You know, and so it's a tiny drone. Things about fits in your palm. You know, it's, you make some wires and stuff. And it's, the idea is that imagine the part that has the rotor, those two rotor things are also spinning so fast too, that you're just not going to see. I mean, you're in it, and they're showing it in broad daylight in the middle of a lit room.
Oh, yeah.
And even then, it still looks hard to see.
Well, and especially at night, I still don't know. I remember it was just over 10 years ago, the first time we were walking, back when Trudy's was still open, we were walking on that same road, and then we just saw the red and green lights of a drone zip overhead and never knew what it was. And I'm seeing less of that now, or maybe they're just quiet. Like, are they, did drone delivery work out? Are there a lot of places you can get drones to deliver stuff?
I think they're just starting that out. What happened too was that they started cracking down on a lot of drones because they had enough collisions and stuff with the airplanes that,
yeah,
that they started showing up at people's houses more often.
Yeah.
Yeah. But you think about this, it is, you think about when these things get more capable and steerable and a swarm, it's like a force field.
Well, that is something that I'll peek in on time to time, just the unbelievably coordinated hive activity of a gigantic drone show. Have you watched a drone show live?
Yeah. Trying to realize, I saw some
not
4th of July.
I have not seen one live, but I like the visuals are just extraordinary. It's giant particle physics where they virtualize fireworks displays. It's bonkers.
Where rockets are? We saw just the tail end of one. But they're doing a thing too, like they do this for LA and stuff for like big movie releases, like when the season 2 of Monarch came out, they did like a giant Godzilla in the sky doing this. They'll do it with Darth Vader, they'll do that. And the main thing is the cost of this is going to fall down to such a point that I could see cities and stuff doing nightly, you know, drone displays or things like this, because, you know, like we're looking at a giant purple tiger over a city, and it's like, why not just do that at night? Why not just have some kind of cool thing? We live in, you know, in Bay Area here. Like, why not have something super cool over the bay?
It's bonkers. You know? It is a bonkers display. And it's funny because there's a magician who hired me for a couple days of ideation for consulting. And this is a big magician who had big budgets, who we both know. I pitched essentially this kind of hive drone display thing before, at the time. I mean, certainly a lot of people had to have had the same idea, but I think it was essentially this idea, and to see it happen and be such a thing is freaking rad.
Yeah, I think that's the thing, is the cost of these continues to fall. I've seen some cool daylight ones too that use like LED curtains and stuff. I do think we're just going to, it's going to become much like the, you know, the big inflatable figures that people put out in front of car dealerships and stuff.
It'll be cliche. I can see, yeah, this
become, but kind of cool. It's an opportunity. The neat thing is that you can just do something different. And I do think it brings us closer to, you know, you think about every science fiction movie has some floating hologram stuff. And it turned out, well, you know, we've got to use our pixels are, you know, the size of a dinner plate, and it's a much bigger show, but it will look like that. And I do think that you'll start to make these things more robust and whatever, and cheaper and disposable. That kind of cool.
It's astonishing, man. Dear listener, take a look at this. Go type in just drone show and see what you could see.
Yeah, if we went back in time when we first started doing this show, and I think we take these things for granted, the scale and the scope of these drone shows now, like we would be like, yeah, that feels like the few. But if you just showed this thing was going on in the sky and we asked, like, how is it being done? I don't know. I think I'd be like, I don't know, maybe lasers hitting vapor or something. Yeah. You're like, no, drones.
Yeah, right? It's crazy. Specifically, we're looking at the Guinness Book of World Records drone, world's largest drone show. Man, it is legendary.
Oh, yeah. And there's going to be, you know, some go to Home Depot and buy the Halloween drone kit that you put in your front yard. And
wow. This stuff looks like a scene straight out of Blade Runner. It is, because keep in mind, there are so many bright lights and it's such a wide space. It's literally lighting up the city. The entire city is washed in the glow of this unbelievably gigantic display. When did this one happen? This is bigger than I ever thought. Yeah, 4 months ago. Wow. That is
why I'm
really
not worried about China taking over. They're just wasting all their money on drone shows.
Yeah, sure. That's they got no other ideas to do with that.
Yeah, none at all.
Yeah,
amazing.
Bonkers.
So,
how long? Right now we're still at the part where you would play with a single drone, but pretty soon, I'd imagine that you could buy a box of a drone cloud. This is going to be just like with fireworks. You'd have your local guy putting on a show. You could vibe code a whole presentation for this. That's going to be within the next couple of years. Your local guy is going to impress the neighborhood with his own drone show. Christmas decorations going to get all droned out.
We can, remember, the things are still noisy, so they're going to limit it. So we can buy a drone show.
How much, I'll lock in my guess. Man, just, that's a lot of pixels. How much, it's got to be what, $20 a pixel? That's what I'm going to guess. That is $20 a pixel.
Like, there's one where you can, I'm trying to, like, on one hand, I said, like, commercial drone light show starting at $40,000 investment versus a 10 drone starter kit starts at about $13,000.
10 drone?
Drone blocks. I mean, that's a small number. Like, yeah, you can actually buy drone blocks, like a light show kit.
That's crazy.
Robo show plotter. Yeah, just buy your kit to see how many you want to add.
Bonkers. Bonkers, bonkers. Totally rad. So what else has gone weird?
Yeah. But I think we've talked about this before, that when you're looking at an AI economy and you look at where things are going, you know, when the direction's going there, you have to see that it's hard for us to imagine how much bigger other things become. Outdoor entertainment, visual entertainment that you would be spending. If I said, hey, you know, if you're, you know, somebody mentioned they're doing this, I think it, what'd they say, Busch Gardens or whatever, they're doing the drone show there nightly. You know, if I said, you know, 20 years ago, hey, I want to spend some money on an outdoor show at night, you'd be like, well, you mean fireworks? Like, or lasers. We can do fireworks or lasers.
Yeah.
You know, that was it. And now you're like, oh, we can do drone show. We can do this. We can do that. And we're going to be inventing more stuff.
It's so bonkers.
I want to pull up, you know, I follow these kind of cool YouTube sites that have like some really cool science stuff. I was trying to find some interesting stuff. And I was trying to find, was going through my YouTube history to find one of these things. But one of the things was this cool video that was talking about, like, there's a paper that came out a couple of years ago that made the suggestion that black holes, and when you're trying to reconcile like quantum mechanics and relativity, you get a disconnect. Because, you know, when you try to figure out how gravity works, et cetera, and then also if you look at like how a black hole, you know, where does information go? Because like quantum mechanics, like the information doesn't get stored. You can't destroy information in quantum mechanics. In relativity, you have a thing called a black hole, which in theory, nope, the information's gone. And that's where the idea of Hawking radiation came from. Partially it was from that. And then somebody, the idea that what if like black holes are basically quantum tunneling to other objects in a strange way, that like that's where the information goes, but like to another universe.
Right.
Because there was this, there was a if you follow the whole, what we've been doing with the whole, our building out to listen to gravity waves, right? The whole experiment, the LIGO and all that, where we're basically, what we do is we have these detectors, we have a couple of them around the world. And when you get two black holes that start to swirl around each other and then merge, it creates a big ripple in gravity. And these detectors try to listen for that, to try to detect, like, because they just, you know, tiny imperceptible sort of change in the gravity wave hits it. And if they figure it where it hits two detectors, they have an idea kind of generally where it is or whatever. And so there was an event where they, because they can see this sort of waveform of like, as they, you think of like a penny going around a drain and they look for this pattern. They can tell that's two black holes somewhere in our universe that are starting to orbit each other, or, you know, billion years ago, whatever, orbit each other and now have collapsed and created this gravity wave.
How much time? So this is an actual detector that we have. You said LIGO?
Yeah, LIGO. Yeah, they have a couple of detectors around the world that use these big, long, like laser beams that wait for to see, detect like the inference to see if something, you know, if they get two points at the same point, they get the same interference.
That's
crazy. And it looks for the pattern. It happens within like seconds. Like that's the crazy part, is you get this thing and you pick up, you see this location, get it, location B around the world, detect it. Like we both detect at the same time.
Got it. Okay. So the penny going around the circle thing, I assume like you don't really hear this. You hear the sound of the penny going at first, but then there's a moment where it hits the threshold right at the end where it's unmistakably making like a noise, and then it just stops.
Two of them colliding. This is two, when the two points they collide.
Right.
Is where you get this, you know, this gravity event, which you can detect, you know, millions of light years away.
Right. So we're listening and we hear essentially the penny equivalent of two black holes hitting the reed and then
yeah,
stop
we start
moment.
To hear, we can, we know the pattern of like, oh, this is when they're getting closer. Blink, and you let.
Yeah.
So there was an instance where they had a gravity wave, and we've been finding tons of these, because you know, the universe is big. You know, two black holes are colliding every day. And there was an event where they had part of the pattern, or like part of the pattern, and then missing the other part. Like it was the other part of it was missing, and it was like one chunk of it was gone. And somebody wrote the paper, researchers wrote a paper, which they're like, hey, we have an idea. You may not like the idea, but it fits if certain things are true. What if that was coming through a wormhole from another universe?
Oh, what if we found the outdoor? Wow.
Yeah. And the idea too, because there is this idea, because the idea that black holes could be quantumly entangled events, that a black hole could be quantumly entangled to some other thing, a wormhole or something, the other side of the universe, in our another universe even, the idea that this thing happened and that's what it was. So is this more like, hey, just, we're not saying it's this, but if this is true and this is true, then it could be this, which I thought was such a cool idea. Like, did we just hear a wormhole for the first time?
That's crazy. I love those moments where the math checks out, and not all of them ends up being right, but like the moment that the math worked out for many worlds being true was, not that we have any way to directly test, but it certainly seems like every possible thing that is ever happening is in a universe next door.
Yeah, it's, and we start off with crazy ideas. You know, black holes, the idea of a black hole was this crazy notion of what if matter becomes so dense that it creates this event where nothing can escape from it, light or whatever. And it's just like there. And then all of a sudden we found like, yeah, that turns out that happens. And we found out they're really common. We find out there's a big one sit in the middle of our galaxy. And then we find out that there's other ones that are so much bigger. The thing too is the density that you need to make a black hole, it's sort of like inverse to like what are the size of it is. So if you want to have a black hole the size of our solar system, it doesn't have to be, doesn't actually have to be as super dense as you might think it would be. It could literally be, it'd feel like a cloud, but it's dense enough to basically bend everything inside of it. Because there's, you look at like, there's a Sagittarius, there's Ton 168, which are bigger, like several times the size of our solar system.
Mm.
And like, there's these super, super massive black holes that just sort of defy
our idea
of what they
should be. Black hole the size of our whole solar system. So,
way bigger, yeah.
And by the way, that's something that I always had a hard time wrapping my mind around was, if it kind of has infinite gravity, then how could it be a smaller version or a larger version? But I guess really when you think of it as kind of a cliff's edge of an extremely, and specifically what I'm thinking of is the first time I read about the idea of micro black holes that evaporate, which sounds crazy, but I guess.
Yeah, all black holes eventually, that's what Hawking radiation is, the idea that eventually gives up everything, it radiates away, but over an impossible amount of time, hundreds of trillions of years, you know, they're like literally the black hole radiates off all of that.
Got it. So it's equivalent to if you picture an eddy, I don't know. I guess basically things are spinning and you get what, the X-ray radiation shooting out the top and bottom sides?
Well, yeah, you get like there's an outer area where there's certain things like the Hawking radiation and that it radiates away. So Ton 618, this one is 18 billion light years from Earth. It is 40 billion times the mass of the sun.
Wow.
And there's also Phoenix A, which is even bigger. Like, if you look at, they have a graphic and they'll show you Phoenix A, Ton 618, and then orbit of Neptune. And Phoenix A is like, so much, much bigger. Like it's several astronomical units across. Like it's insane.
That's crazy. Speaking of crazy things in space, did you happen to see the sharpest image ever taken of the sun?
Yeah, man. That's that looks like a pretty turbulent thing.
Yeah, so this is, there was one that put it in perspective, but basically this center chunk right here is 100 kilometers apart. And at 100 kilometers, you can squint and you can wrap your mind around, like, I have seen a hurricane that size or, you know, an image. Actually, yes, a hurricane of that size. There's little eddies in there, and it's thought that in the turbulence is the reason that the surface of the sun is so much hotter than the inside. Like, basically, I assume that it boils down to, with all those folds and the turbulence, it's the equivalent of massive surface area, basically.
There was a illustration in a book, like, I think I may have had it as a kid. It was about the future, and it was talking about colonizing the solar system. And my favorite one from there, like, I'm a kid, I don't think I stopped to process it, was somebody is like, you know, what if sunspots were cool enough that you could just build a colony on it? and I was like, you know, 9 years old, whatever. I'm like, all right, that sounds cool. And then like adult me is like, just because this spot, even assuming that a sunspot was, you know, mere, you know, tens of thousands of degrees, or even it's something habitable, like, you're still, I don't know, 1,000 miles away from the effing sun, you know, like, you're not, it's a terrible place. It was just a cool, like, illustration of this colony on the sun, like, the idea that there's the rest of the sun here, and there's a spot where they just built a colony on a, you know, one, you know.
Not, yeah, bit of a, you'd be heavy there. that was one of the things we talked about, must have been 10, 12 years ago, was there was some article proposing like, yes, of course, we're going to terraform Mars first, but hear me out. What if we built floating cities on the high pressure atmosphere of Venus where we could have 1G and you just, you know, because gravity for the human body, fairly important for the bones and staying alive and whatnot. But anyway, I love the idea that
big gravity tells you.
What's that?
That's what big gravity tells you.
Big gravity. But I love the idea of like the most inhospitable planet that we could think of maybe would be an okay choice to move to.
I mean, Venus sucks for a lot of reasons.
The specific proposal was,
it was like, you know, we just figure out how to float in the clouds as you do. And I'm like, okay, why are we going there? Like, we want to get on the surface in Mars. We want to get in the surface and dig and build. And it's like, no, it's going to be this in the clouds. Like, why are we going there then? What are you doing?
Yeah.
You know, like, we'll build probes to go down on the surface. Okay, then just build habitats on the surface. I was like, you know, if we're, you know, I'm all for exploration. Yes, I 100% like, I think if we're like, if, you know, 20 years from now, NASA's like, we're going to build a floating observatory that sits on top of the clouds of Venus. I'm like, yeah, let's do that. It's awesome.
Yeah. Well, but now we're at the part in history where it used to be the answer was, oh, well, you can't trust a probe or remote or blah, blah, blah. You need a human there to do all of the tough decision, load-bearing decisions and so on. And then nowadays it's like, yeah, or for ounces on the 100 pounds, you could just send machines that are going to do a fine job.
Yeah, I think they'll get there. I think we'll get there where the machines are pretty good, but there is a thing too of like, why do we go there? You know, why do we do it? And I'm look at how many people watched Artemis 2.
Yeah.
You know, nothing happened on there that a space probe hadn't done before, but I'm like, a big part of this all is like, let's see if we can go live in space.
Yeah. I'm real glad that went as well as it did. Boy, am I glad. Yeah. Boy, did I not care for how nervous I was.
Yeah. Yeah, I can name a handful of people who were really super glad it went really well. That was cool. It was exciting to see, you know, we had this, that we get into this sort of pessimism from time to time of like, people don't care anymore. I'm like, yeah, we got tired of like, you know, the sixth or seventh, you know, third or fourth moon mission because literally, we're at the moon. Like, yeah, cool. What's going on? You know, we're going to play golf. You know, like, okay. And you get that like, wow, people don't care. I'm like, if it's a new thing, we'll get excited about it. But when it's, and I get like the really important science, I get it. I'm a fan for that. But a lot of it was just this idea of like, we can't be as excited about the second trip to the moon as we were about the first trip.
Well, and remember that the whole reason we went to the moon was kind of a hybrid thing. It's convenient that we got a little bit of science done along the way, but in an extraordinary maneuver, instead of having a human killing war, we decided to have a cool storytelling war with the USSR. And so, and in that regard, like ratings, it really was the ratings war, and the ratings, you know, there's, you can't keep mining that same dopamine with the same story.
Yeah, it's gotta be continue to do that. And it's hard because, you know, it's hard when you're trying to do things in the world of science too. And, you know, I remember having a conversation with somebody once who was, some people who are like, what if we made scientists famous like rock stars? I'm like, why do you hate science that much? You know, like you let a person alone, give them resources, let them spend several years to come up with something cool. But then you're going to create a situation where we're not going to think they're cool unless we understand it. So then we're going to force them to have to do stuff that we think is cool. And then, you know, we kind of did that with Ted. And
yeah, well, and then what happened
is
well, you create incentives where the skill set, turns out the skill set to be a scientist, not necessarily the skill set to be a rock star, and just wishing for the one to be the other. You know, you know what happens is a lot of rock stars put on lab coats and announce that they're scientists now.
That's you know, kind of what happens. I notice there's a certain kind of personality gets attracted towards it, and you know.
I want to give a shout out. So when I was in Portland, we did a little meetup, and originally I announced it on the Cord Killers podcast, but one of the folks that showed up, her name is Amber, and she described running across the Weird Things podcast a few years ago. And because this is the way Amber rolls, she went back and listened to all 990 plus episodes of Weird Things from the beginning. Now, she didn't do it in a row. She's got this amazing system where what she does is when a podcast is interesting, she adds it to the mix. And she listens to podcasts all day, every day, but like once per day, there would be a Weird Things episode that she would listen to all the way back from episode one up to, we're at 996 is our official count right now. How amazing is that? And it's like to be there for all of it. I mean, I guess we were there for all of it. And you know what? You too, dear listener, you should be there for all of it, all the way back to the beginning.
Fun fact, not all three of us have been on all episodes.
So
she
Amber is the
goat. Participated in more Weird Things episodes than anyone
we
have.
Congratulations, Amber. You may be the only person on the planet who has completed the Weird Things challenge. How amazing is that?
Yeah, like if Brian's not on an episode and Jess and I record it, Brian's not going to go back. Brian's got
other in the early days, know. I did, but then you know, around year four or five, it's like we all got stuff to do.
Then there were other podcasts in the olden times.
Yes.
So we got NSW show and Weird Things. All right.
It's like, yeah, it's like, well, what am I going to do on this run? Might as well listen to the one so I can talk about it on the other.
Yeah. Amazing.
Yeah. Nowadays, she mentioned a specific podcast app. In fact, write us, brian@schwa.com, Amber, if you remember what it was. But it's like a 10-year-old app that setting of just sort of add it to my favorites, and then it just kind of like a radio station put it in the queue. Like, and that makes sense. Like, there would be talk radio shows that I'd listen to every single day when I had a day job. That makes sense.
Yeah. Want to do picks?
Yeah, dude. You know what? I got a couple of picks. I've been reading really good stuff.
Do it multiple. No rules, man.
I
mean, if Amber allows it.
Yes. Well, I'll tell you, I'll go in reverse order. The one I'm listening to today is Pitch Anything by Oren? Let me see. Oren Claff, Klaff, an innovative method for presenting, persuading, and winning the deal. And this is ostensibly about like you're trying to pitch for venture capital or any of that stuff. But truthfully, it's just a different type of selling. And it's one of those, I can already tell, it's only 4.5 hours long. I'm going to go back and reread it again. I'm only an hour and a half into it. But it's one of those core ways of seeing things that's so dead simple, I can't unsee it. And he says, here's the mismatch. We're gonna be overly simplistic here. You've got three brains. You got the first one to evolve was your crocodile brain, the lizard brain, your autonomic system. What does it know? It knows I'm under threat. That's the amygdala is in charge. You got the your middle brain. That's the one that plugs in.
It's got a problem.
What's that?
Sorry.
This is metaphor, right? You got your middle brain. That's the one that, you know, cities evolve and you know your status. So the middle brain is all in on what is my hierarchy. Think chimps, primates, right? What's my status? Where, how do I plug in here? Am I under threat from within the tribe? And then you've got your prefrontal cortex, your neocortex. And that's where your high-minded ideas is. Here's the mismatch. When you have a pitch, whether it's for a Halloween party, whether it's for the prom, whether it's for a local ordinance, whatever, there's some point you meet other people. You are pitching from your neocortex. And you forget that they are only listening from their crocodile brain. They're thinking about, does this threaten me? Do I want to fight it or mate with it? Is it dead simple? And when you, yes, use your neocortex for whatever your great idea is, but pitching is its own dance. And you have to remember that you need them to feel safe and instantly able to get the little bits and make it so that each piece of what you're saying, they will want to say yes to and participate. And of course, if you've ever pitched anything, whether it's a TV show or a book or what have you, you know that a lot of times people will use power to set the frame, or like, I only have 5 minutes. Give me the whatever, whatever. And if you take that at face value, then your pitch is going to fall flat. And instead, what he suggests is, what they're doing is they're proposing a frame. Tell me everything in 5 minutes. If you say yes, you are accepting the frame. And that's one where it's going to be too easy to deflect. And instead, what you could do is take that opportunity to propose a counter frame. How do you do that? For example, you get pulled over by a cop and you decide, oh, I'm going to say I didn't know I was speeding. And then that's the frame you've picked. And then he's like, well, here's radar. It says you're speeding. The end. And you lost. Whereas meanwhile, that story that I tell in the social engineering talk I'm told this will help in pulling out a get out of jail free card. That is an adjacent story where I hold all the power. Or imagine if I get pulled over and the first words out are like, sorry, I just finished a grad night party. I'm a magician. You want to see a trick? Ha ha. Now, at this point, if he says, yeah, I do want to see the trick, then already it's over with. I'm not going to pay for this ticket.
Well, the state trooper, you always do, but I'm going to make you do a breathalyzer test if you just say, I just finished a grad night party.
Fair enough. But that's the other thing is most of us don't think about what frame we're opening and what dance and negotiation we're doing. And so it's one of those, like, for the moment, the moment he said that, I went back and I thought about a bunch of times that I had successful talks, pitches, good showcases in the college market, even the talk I did at DEF CON. I was like, oh, it checks all of those boxes. And then I thought about all the times that stuff didn't work out, and it was very clear. Yeah, they set the frame, and I engaged when the deck was stacked against me. It was great.
I think about, like, I remember once I got pulled over heading into Las Vegas for work and working on a TV show. And it was a BS thing. He had a radar thing that said, you were going this fast. I'm like, I'm on a rental car. I couldn't go that fast. But I didn't argue. He says, like, he asked me, you headed here for fun or for work or whatever. And I just got to see some friends. And I was actually going to go work. And I realized I'd said work. I'm no longer an idiot tourist speeding. I'm, you know, a person just trying to get to a job.
Yeah.
You know, and it was like that. Because I'm usually like, coming to Florida, I'd get pulled over. State troopers there will always give you, they'll give other cops tickets. But I've been pulled over by the police. So where you come? Coming from my parents' house. Where do your parents live? Here, later. Don't get a ticket. You know, if I'm like, oh, I'm out with friends, don't get a ticket, you know.
Well, there was a time that a friend of mine was raising hell as a college student, but I, regardless of what condition he was actually in at the time when he got pulled over, he said the words, sorry about these guys, I'm the designated driver. And that was enough of a frame for the cop to say, well, somebody is being responsible, and let him go.
Yeah. Yeah. I have a pick, a little personal. Several years ago, I was going through YouTube and I found some very funny videos by a creator who didn't have like a ton of follows or views, but like just one of them just caught my eye. It was so very, very funny. And I reached out to him. His name was Alex Olam. I said, Alex, this is great stuff. Told him about myself, you know, worked in TV and stuff, less, whatever. If I could ever be helpful, let me know. Kid followed me up. Like, yeah, you know, any advice? And so, started talking to him. He was still in college at that point and, you know, said, I can introduce you to some people in LA, help you however I can. I don't think any of that was like super helpful for him. He was already pretty driven. Told him, if you ever plan on making a feature film, let me know. And he says, I have an idea after I graduate, want to work with my friends, want to make a film. year later, gets hold of me, says, hey, I have my budget. I have know what I want to do. He was super respectful, very, very thoughtful, and laid out everything. I want to pay the actors, they get paid, but my friends will work as crew. They'll work for participation. Oh, I can use this. They have a video projection stage. He was going to FSU that I can use there. Laid out his budget, laid out his plan. And I said, okay, well, I'll do this. So I, you know, gave him some money to go start the film, gets into the film, gets midway through production. I gets like finishes up, but they need to shoot some more stuff. Says, I need to raise some more money. He raised it for me and a couple other people. And he drove all the way up from, you know, this point from LA up to my house up in, you know, the Bay Area, showed my wife and I the work in progress. I asked Roshni, I said, what do you think? She says, yeah, I think he's really got something here. So we said, Alex, we'll help you out. We'll continue this on. Not thinking we're ever going to see the money back. Just yeah. The idea that he's a young creator, extremely respectful. I work with other people that I've given money to make stuff. And then it gets become almost resentful. Like they come back for more and the production's a disaster. And then it's like, Alex was always respectful about this, whatever. And the movie's called It Ends. You might have seen some of the promo. It's been after we backed him, the producers of Backrooms came on to the film. It's getting a theatrical release next week from Neon. They're doing promos around the country. They're doing a thing in New York City where they're going to do a 36-hour marathon where you can try to sit through all the way. We're going to the premiere in LA next week. Alex is an extremely thoughtful filmmaker. Very, very bright, very considerate. You know, he's like, you know, I made this movie that like 4 years ago. I feel like I've moved on as a filmmaker. He's on set with his next feature, which is a multi-million-dollar feature film. And wow. He kind of just did everything really right.
That's amazing.
I'm proud of this. Yeah, because he was a brilliant director. The producer of Backrooms came on board. He's in the same group as Cory Barker, who did Obsession, and Kane Parsons, who did Backrooms. And so Alex is another one of these sort of great new directors. It's a very cool existential sort of thing. It's very much he wanted to do a Gen Z kind of like metaphysical sort of thing. You may have seen on Instagram some other stuff for it, but when they come to the card with the credits card for this, and my wife and I, our names are right on the poster. We're right on in the trailer. And I've had other people I've helped out that are then like, you know, I don't know why really. And it's like this kid, a really, really high integrity, really, really high integrity.
That's amazing. So,
yeah, I could not be more proud. It's just, you know, you back a bunch of different people and, you know, I don't regret anything. And some people just keep going and going and going and do really well by it. And, you know, just really proud of the kid. You know, he's been very thoughtful, very, very much, you know, really, you know, in his moment right now. Pause it.
Oh, wait. Here, let me go back. I almost paused it, but then I didn't. Oh, wait, no, go back.
Brian, you're very bad at this.
Hey, Andrew Main! Man. Rush Bacha, that's amazing.
Yeah.
That is
I have another friend who
amazing.
I gave about as much money to start his project. And then he came up to like, and it was a disaster. We told him it'd be a disaster, but I liked him, wanted to help him out. And then when it came time, like credits, like, well, you know, you didn't, you know, like he had to go raise a lot. Alex, they all ended up raising a ton more money.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, but like, because we were the first money in, that's the name, the first money people in. This other guy's like, well, you guys didn't contribute as much. It's like, dude, we were your first money.
Yeah.
We were your first check outside of your family. Some people get it. Some people don't. I don't care. I don't need to have my name on a movie. Well, I'm proud to have it here because Alex is a great kid. But it is sometimes, you know, people get into that like, well, did you really do that much for me? Did you really do that? And it's like, eh, you know.
That's so wild because, I don't know. I don't want to get in the whole game of, like credits was one of those things where when Hollywood happened that I was like, I was really confused. Now I understand a little bit better. It's like, well, if you're in a zero sum ladder based, you know, organism in Hollywood, then, you know, you fight like the devil.
Oh, no, but
there
are standards, the rules, the practices. You know, I had another person I helped out who then like, well, I had other people coming to bring more money. I'm like, right, because I financed you to get to the point that you got there.
Right.
Like, that's you don't say
well, but somebody I guess else. That's the part that blows my mind. It's like, why would you say no if somebody cares about that? I don't know.
Oh no, I don't. It was a very. I think he was that other person was upset that I had put more money into it, but I was also like, he was not. Alex was extremely respectful with everybody's time and what went into it. We understood where it was spent, what was doing. We knew we cared about it. When he raised money to do more, it was literally because the movie had momentum. It's like, you need to do professional banks. And he brought in Hollywood money. Like we helped him a bit, but then the vast majority was paid for by like the producers of back rooms and everything else like that.
Yeah.
Like what we contributed was super tiny in comparison to that. Leaving that very clear.
Well, that's great. When does this come out?
Next week.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Yeah.
I can't wait.
But and I tell you, sometimes, you know, as a creative, the best thing you can do as a creative is to find another creative and just say, how can I be helpful?
Yeah, dude, that is one of the cheat codes. I think a lot about, you know what? I do have the other pick that I was waiting to discover. Two voices that I hear in my head a whole bunch are Stephen Pressfield's and Rick Rubin. Well, guess what? Stephen Pressfield was on Rick Rubin's podcast, and the two of them go as wild-eyed hippie as you could possibly imagine. They both believe in magical things. Stephen Pressfield, in his book, The Art of War, talks about resistance with a capital R, a malevolent force that keeps you from achieving your artistic purpose by throwing BS in front of you at all times. And meanwhile, Rick Rubin talks about getting in touch with what he calls capital S source, this hippie attunement for the essence of what's good art. Anyway, if you just you've heard us talk about Stephen Pressfield stuff before, Rick Rubin, epic producer, music producer. Listen to the two of them talking in on YouTube. Just search Stephen Pressfield and Rick Rubin.
Amazing. Other pick. Oh, other thing too. Like my dad. I helped my dad. My dad wrote his biography.
Oh, wow.
It's law enforcement biography. It's available now on Amazon, called The Long Beat by Jim Harder. I'm like, hey, you have different names. Like, yeah, I'm in witness protection.
Yeah.
Jim Harder, James Harder. Look up James Harder, The Long Beat. Great, great stories. My dad had an incredible law enforcement journey from working as a, James Harder, sorry. Working as a moon, going after, you worked at Atlanta Police Department, going after, that's great. Reviews. Something's not happening.
I'll fix that review.
Going after moonshiners. You're going to get the, I hate cops in there. Going after moonshiners, all sorts of stuff. You know, just incredible sort of journey through law enforcement. So I was very, very happy to help him put this together.
That's great. That's great. A law enforcement's journey from moonshine backroads to cocaine wars.
Yeah, my dad like started off, you know, Atlanta Police Department, and then basically, you know, arrested the guy that narked on Manuel Noriega.
Whoa.
Just literally, yeah.
Literally.
Yeah, I mean, literally quite the career.
That's amazing. That's
sorry, I paused on my delivery on that, like, you know, great, literally. Then I did a pause because I looked to hold up the page. I got distracted. By the way, too, Spider-Man.
Yeah, I thought it was pretty good. It's like my fourth favorite Spider-Man movie, but the number one biggest box office winner of all time. Yeah.
Oh, maybe it's my second probably favorite.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it's pretty good. You can tell they're doing some setups on everything. Oh, by the way, shouts out to Creator Ant, who's in the chat right now. I've seen some of Creator Ant stuff on my feed.
Cool.
But the Spider-Man, it was doing a lot of jobs. And when it was doing the job of telling a good Spider-Man story, I liked it a lot.
I loved it. Don't care. Don't listen to Brian, everybody. Amazing. It's amazing. It's awesome. I enjoyed it. I remember when I saw Dark Knight. I'm like, it's long. But I'm like, what would I take out? I'm like, nothing.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. I'd like, what's your Spider-Man ranking, your favorite ones?
I forget the names. First of all, the one with the three Spider-Man was amazing. And keep in mind, if we're going to call it the second place, then that means we have to put all the Tobey Maguire Spider-Man behind it. And I had a lot of fun on the first couple of Spider-Man movies. I don't know that this one, like there are iconic moments in those first two Sam Raimi ones that I would have to put at the very top.
Yeah, it's weird because, like, I'm a fan of Raimi, and I enjoyed the first one. I've maybe seen it twice.
Yeah.
I've maybe seen it that. I've never gone back. Of the all of them, I liked the first Andrew Garfield. I liked that. I watched that probably more than the first Sam Raimi. Spider-Man Homecoming, I loved. I've watched that multiple times.
Yeah, that was great.
I think it's phenomenal. Far From Home, I thought was super, super fun. No Way Home, my least favorite. It's the clunkiest of them for me.
No Way Home, is that the Mysterio one?
No, that's Far From Home. No Way Home is the three, the other Spider-Man.
Really? Spoiler. How about that?
Yeah, it's such a clunky movie to me.
Yeah, I don't know. It delivered some delightful surprises that I just was amazed that it was huge.
It's like this. I think the two of these are kind of similar in the sense that, like, if you're in for it and, like, the story's going to sprawl and go this way, it's great. If you're like, all right, I want to get back to this, then it's like, you're like, and like, I don't begrudge anybody who loves that one.
Yeah.
You know, I will go like, it's so clunky. This one, I just, you know, Punisher and Spider-Man, all that. I was like,
when it was Punisher and Spider-Man, 10 out of 10. Great. A little bit of friendly neighborhood Spider-Man riff, but great. Look, I don't want to cite all the things that I didn't love, but I did love.
Both those movies are going to do fine without our endorsements.
I know.
Somewhere Kevin Feige is like, God, Ryan, Andrew, like, Jesus, you know?
One
of your friends write a movie that I should have let him write.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like, congrats. Here's some action figures. Write your own version. Okay.
That's right.
Sign brings up whether or not, do we count the Spider-Verse? Because I'll put Across the Spider-Verse, maybe at the very tippy top. Boy, did I love the first one, Into the Spider-Verse.
I loved it the first time. Not an easy watch for me the second time. Sometimes a J.J. Abrams film is like fun 70 or 80% through the watch. And then you get to the end, you're like, yeah, that's cool. And then you kind of think of the parking lot, and then you kind of go home. I think Spider-Verse is way better.
Yeah.
But once the novelty, that's the thing, that's the same with the Sam Raimi stuff. Once the novelty of Peter Parker discovering the thing, is even watching that movie again is much fun for me.
Yeah.
You know, Far From Home was fun for me because there's a lot of really clever stuff there. Or excuse me, No Way, Homecoming rather. But they're great though. But again, Sony's problem, their production pipeline is terrible. So we're finally getting the sequel to Across the Spider-Verse. Like, they did not green light those at the same time. And then, you know, the K-pop Demon Hunter, same thing. Like, they just literally did not want to pay for that.
Yeah. This just in, Spider-Man Brand New Day tanks in box office after live stream discussion. I'm sorry. What hell hath we wrought?
Somebody needs to do a post-mortem on Ain't It Cool News in the early 90s and early aughts, because we have an entire generation that never got to experience what it was like to literally watch the entire film industry be manipulated by some pasty Austin geeks.
Yeah. Yeah. That would be a good doc. Well, actually, I don't know if it'd be a good doc. It would be a doc I would want to watch, though.
Oh, I think it'd be a great, I think that's the right way to do it. Like I said, I think a documentary would be a great way to do it. Because I think that, so if those of you don't know, there was a site called Ain't It Cool News, and Ain't It Cool, as you all know, was a great catchphrase from what movie?
Oh, shoot. Which one?
Broken Arrow.
Oh my God. No, I didn't even know that.
Ain't it cool? So Ain't It Cool News. And basically it was a site for like all sorts of news. It's still around, but I don't know if anybody goes there. Site for all kinds of movie gossip and stuff. And what they did was they would read things on other websites and then submit it like, oh, my trip, it was classic how you do this. They like launder like, oh, so-and-so saw this, so-and-so saw this. You know, Moriarty, these characters that would start talking about like seeing, you know, the gossip and stuff, and they just make stuff up flat up. But so many people went to it that then studios would go try to do it, and it launched Blair Witch Project.
It was like, whether or not it was a fantasy or an overstatement to begin with, they did start getting stolen scripts and all of that stuff. The fantasy became real.
Well, what they got was sometimes either screenwriters who wanted their pitch to get attention or people who hated a pitch and wanted to see it killed would leak to it. And then they would talk about like the way you built buzz for movies would be like, oh, I just saw a screen. I live in a college town. I just saw this screening for this movie. It was amazing. You know, secret screening. And it was just filmmakers making up screenings that never took place.
Oh, that's
great. How they built up Blair Witch Project. The Blair Witch Project, like, nobody had seen it. But they created this fake buzz of just, like, saying, like, oh, yeah, I saw it. It's great. And some other people picked up the game, like, oh, we don't actually have to do a screening. We just have a credible person feed enough stories in there, then go in and say, I saw it, and have other people go in and do it. And that became...
It's like, if what you want is buzz, why bother to have an event and hope that it catches buzz? Why not just go straight to make buzz go?
Yep.
That's so bonkers.
All right. Go see a movie.
Yeah. How's it
been? Brian, it ends.
Yeah. Bye.